This is episode 13 of Ben and Matt's Marvelous Journey. My name is Matt Waters. I'm joined by Ben Phillips. Ben, how are you on Mother's Day in the UK to date the recording?
I'm good. I have barely done anything today.
Same. I've just recovered from a visit from relatives, so, you know. That's the spirit of Mother's Day. So this is Ben and Matt's Marvelous Journey. We are taking a deep dive into the entire history of the MCU. One film per episode, obviously, as we count down towards 10-year anniversary and Infinity War. This is episode 13, which means it's Captain America Civil War, not Infinity
War.
I'm
super excited for when we do all the individual episodes for the Marvel TV shows.
Yeah, obviously, one episode per episode. So we'll just be podcasting until the end of time. We may do something with the TV stuff, but I just don't like having to marathon a whole TV show for an episode, but you know, we'll see what happens. But yeah, this is Civil War. Depending on what day of the week you ask me on, I might say this is my favorite Marvel movie. It's certainly way up there if it isn't number one. I remember being ridiculously excited for it when they announced it, and I remember going to see it and being blown away. It came right in the midst of Batman vs. Superman just before it, and then X-Men Apocalypse was after it. And while obviously those two films aren't as good as this one, it was a lot of get hype type movies with like a huge cast and everything. But yeah, this is clearly the front runner of those three.
I think it's the worst. We're on opposing ends of this. There's a civil war in this episode between the two of us. This movie is bad.
What you're talking about is the comic book. I know you think the comic book is bad. that's all the enthusiasm you'll get from Ben.
All the good stuff in that comic book doesn't happen in the main series. Like, everyone's just like, oh my god, Cap's death. Yeah, you have to read like a side story about that to find out how that happens.
The resolution of that was very dumb. Well, you can talk about that comic book soon, but first I must run down some wonderful information. This was released on May 6th, 2016. Since Ant-Man, we've had Fantastic Four, Deadpool, and Batman v Superman. So the competition finally got their acting gear after Marvel managed to release three films unopposed in a row. This film was released on the year of the 75th anniversary of Captain America and the 50th anniversary of Black Panther, which is fitting as he's in this movie. It's 147 minutes long, so it is the longest film to date. As of this recording, I don't think there's a runtime for Infinity War.
There is 153 minutes.
Ooh, there you go, in with the information. Is there budget yet, or...?
I don't know. I saw it today that Infinity War is confirmed to be the longest Marvel movie so far, and it's 150-something. Don't quote me on 153. Okay. 2 hours, 36 minutes. So, yeah, that is 156 minutes, not 153.
Wow. So, yeah, 9 minutes longer than this one. But that's... So the credits longer than this one. Made it for $250 million, which seems a modest amount of money compared to Age of Ultron's staggering $316, but it is still the second most expensive film they have made as of this recording, so as we don't know how much they're spending on Infinity War, as we've said. It made $1.153 billion, so we're back in that $1 billion, baby. It is the fourth highest grossing Marvel film, I guess, to date. Although, while Black Panther is clearly going to crush all these records, so...
Yeah, Black Panther's crossed $1 billion yesterday, so it's... And China's only just opened, so
yes, and it's opened strong instead of incredibly weak, so I think that thing's going way higher.
It's already in the top 10 highest grossing movies in the US, so...
Wonderful. Wonderful stuff. Have fun, Infinity War. Doesn't matter, it's all Marvel. So, directed by Anthony and Joe Russo, written by Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely. We have been over their credits when we have discussed Winter Soldier. Shockingly, they've done the same amount of things. So the writing team of Marcus and McFeely, they started work on this, writing it in late 2013. The Russos were brought back officially in early 2014, just before Winter Soldier came out, because it was testing really well. And they made details about the film public towards the end of the year. They announced that Civil War title, and I remember that was met with quite a reaction, because obviously, you know, your first thought is, but there's like 100 characters in the comic, and, you know, Marvel only have, I don't know how many on screen, but not that
many. I mean, there's 12 superheroes in this movie, so...
And I remember a friend of mine, like, because he's a dumbass, he was like, oh, I don't want to watch it. Like, there's, like, no one in it. That's lame. That's not a civil war. And it's like, no, you fool. That's not what it means. Anyway. So the writers were talking about wanting to be, like, an amalgamation of the tones of the first two Captain America films. Like, taking the war. It's not really lighthearted, but there's a certain tone to that first one that's... I don't know, there's just something about it. And then the second one's the political one. So they wanted to mash them up. They cited Fargo, the movie, The Godfather, and Seven, as well as basically anything made by Brian De Palma as their biggest influences. They wanted to do a psychological thriller.
Those three movies just seem like they just kind of played Mad Libs, and they were just like, name three movies that we like.
I feel every film like lists The Godfather and The Dark Knight as its inspiration in some way. But yeah, Fargo I can kind of see in a weird way, but yeah. So the oldest ideas for the film featured Crossbones being revealed to be taking orders directly from Red Skull, who would have still been alive, and it didn't have any Civil War stuff in it. All the stuff with Zemo and Bucky was always there, but then Kevin Feige had basically wanted to do Civil War from the moment they announced they were doing an MCU. Like, I think his grand vision for the collective universe was eventually we'll get to a place where we've got enough characters in place where we can do a two teams fighting type scenario. So they slapped Civil War on the top of it, and shockingly that didn't completely break what they had in place, because I mean, you know, all the marketing is look at all these heroes fighting and all that, but if you look at the actual guts of this film, it's a Captain America movie, which is why it's Captain America Civil War, not Avengers Civil War. So they were able to make the movie they wanted to make and just added some stuff on it.
Yeah, I mean, the big deal with the announcement is they announced the title and that Downey Jr. was going to be in it at the same time. Like, it wasn't like Captain America Civil War and then everyone kind of scratching their heads going like, how are Captain America, Falcon, and Black Widow going to make an interesting Civil War movie? They literally came out the guns and said, we've extended Downey's contract, and paying him a shit ton of money to do one extra movie.
Indeed, this was my next point. So they had him scripted for a reasonably short role that would have been done in like less than 3 weeks of filming. He negotiated his way into one of the best contracts in Hollywood, where I think he gets his flat 40 or 50 million, plus if this movie outgrossed Winter Soldier, which it did, he got a bonus, plus I think he got a cut of box office, which is fucking insane. Ike Perlmutter, who was still just about in a position of power at this point, was so outraged by these demands that he ordered they write him out of the film entirely, but Kevin Feige stepped in and was like, Ike, for fuck's sake, dude, have some chill. By the end of the year, Disney had done a restructure and moved Perlmutter sort of to the side, so Kevin Feige now answers directly to Disney and doesn't have to appease this asshole, who I learned while doing this. I mean, we know the thing about him, his opinions on women and stuff. Allegedly, when they swapped Terrence Howard for Don Cheadle, he said black people look the same. So I'm not saying as fact he said this, but given the things that you've heard about this man over the years, I'm not in any way shocked. Jeff Loeb still reports to him, so, you know, just deepening that hatred from Kevin Feige towards TV. Downey's in the movie, Downey's a huge part of it. They have almost similar screen time in a Captain America movie, which is, it's okay, it works well. So in late 2014, some hacked emails from Sony were leaked onto the internet very famously, and we learned that there was an attempt to incorporate Spider-Man into the film, and that these talks had broken down, but then I think it's Sony Japan were like, look, fuck Spider-Man, it's making us no money, just do the deal. And they did, and they announced that in February of 2015 that Spider-Man was going to be in this movie. T'Challa was originally only going to be in this out of his costume in a small role, like just the UN thing, and just looking angry after his father had died. Don't know why I belittled that, like, oh, he's so mad. But yeah, when it looked like they weren't getting Spider-Man, they beefed up his role, and then they did get Spider-Man as well, so they just reduced Spider-Man's presence, which all works out nicely because Homecoming is coming within a year. So Kim Feige, the Russos, and Amy Pascal of Sony, they screen-tested 6 actors to play Spider-Man. The Russos very adamant they wanted a much younger actor, and they made it clear they wanted Tom Holland because of the gymnastics and the dance and all the stuff that he has going for him. And Spider-Man Homecoming director John Watts visited the set during the filming of those scenes, and just so he could get a feel for the direction they were going and like give some notes and all of that good stuff, make sure it's all cohesive. The Wasp was in the script at one point, but they didn't want to have her debut in this movie in such a sort of small fashion, because it would have literally just been turning up for the fight, and that's it. And based on how Ant-Man and the Wasp is looking from the trailers, I'm glad they've made this decision. Hulk was in it at one point. Ruffalo even visited the set, but ultimately they removed him to maintain balance, because in their words, whichever team has Hulk wins. Thunderbolt Ross is back, and they were considering having him turn to Red Hulk, but again, they thought that was too much. A wonderful exercise in restraint is the summary memory of all of this. Gwyneth Paltrow was at one point attached to appear in some reshoots, but they didn't actually have her under contract, so they decided not to. I don't know if she is back under contract now, or if she just did Homecoming on like a one-off basis. But
I think she is back under contract now. I think she's got a role in one of the new Avengers movies. Like,
yeah. Oh, yeah, because she's in the... She's promoted alongside the main cast, isn't she?
Yeah, like, she was there for the Vanity Fair photo shoot and stuff like that, and I feel like you don't do the Vanity Fair photo shoot if you're not still in some way related to the MCU, so...
And then very finally, before you get to talk about a wonderful project that you love and admire, the Russos said that post-production on this was the easiest process they've ever done, because it just everybody was on the same page, so despite how many moving parts there are here, and how we talked about how messy Age of Ultron is, trying to juggle a lot of characters and everything, this was just so one vision and everyone together that it worked. And I think that's 100% why they gave them Infinity War to do, because they clearly run a pretty tight ship and everything goes smoothly and it's still a good quality film, even though it's not Joss Whedon. So
I think it also benefits that it is really pared down to two characters. Yeah. People joke and say this is Avengers 2.5, and yes, there are a lot of Avengers characters in here, but like, the only two characters that get the level of arc are Cap and Tony. Panther gets stuff to do, Bucky gets stuff to do.
And they debut Spider-Man, but it's all pretty small compared to those main two.
And I think that's what really helps. And it's what... I'm not worried about Infinity War, but it is one of the things where I'm glad that they're positing it as being, this is Thanos' story. I'm just like, okay, that's an interesting way to go about it, is if he's the central figure, that makes it more interesting than if it was Infinity War done in the style of Age of Ultron, where Thor has to go off and go on an adventure. Although, from the EW calendar thing that came out today, apparently that's literally what happens to Thor, is he goes off and has his own adventure.
I mean, with that many people, I think 100% we're going to get some of these characters being in the film for like less than 5 minutes, but
Thor's going off with Rocket and Groot. That's what Thor's.
I think across both movies, everyone will get their stuff. It's just, yeah, if you're expecting everybody in this movie to get a fully fleshed out 20-minute arc, that's not happening. But we will see. But Ben, why don't you tell us all about Civil War? Because you've told us a lot about Captain America, so I guess you've got to talk about Civil War.
Civil War is a comic book by Mark Miller and Steve McNiven,
and that's it.
I mean, so basically the story is a small group of superheroes go to take down some supervillains in a small town in the middle of the US. One of the villains turns into a bomb and blows up this town or this school and basically kills the whole...
Man.
He kills kids. And basically what happens is the government does a superhero registration act where all superheroes have to sign up as part of a government program so that their secret identities are known to the world. And basically Cap and Iron Man are on opposing sides of this, Iron Man being all for signing up for the registration act because he's Tony Stark and people at this point know that he's Iron Man, or I think this story reveals that he's Iron Man to the world. And then Cap, even though he is historically people know him as Steve Rogers, he's fighting for the individual rights for people as opposed to government bureaucracy. And that's where the kind of core disagreement comes. And that's all well and good. The idea isn't bad.
I like the setup of Civil War a lot. It just then peters out very quickly.
Yeah, the issue becomes Captain America is very clearly the hero and Iron Man is very clearly the villain, to the extent that, like, as we mentioned previously in this podcast, Iron Man had to have his brain wiped to forget the events of this story so that he could become a hero again, because they took him way too far down this really dark hole. And that's the big issue with the story, is that Mark Miller writes interesting deconstructions of these superhero stories, like in Ultimates, which is very much like extreme Avengers, which has stuff that you would never ever want to do in the actual Avengers title, because you've got stuff like Hulk implying that he wants to have sex with Wasp and stuff like that, and things that make sense in an out-of-continuity story that start to bleed into Civil War, that start to break the Marvel Universe, and they have to do a lot of course correction afterwards. And it is also the start of Marvel's event machine, where they were publishing like 500 tie-ins that you have to read all of them to get the full story. And
for just $500, you can own the entirety of Civil War, however many years after it first was published.
All you need to do is just read Ed Brubaker's Cap Run, and then you're fine. Don't worry. The other key thing to remember in this is that Spider-Man unmasked himself this story. And told the world that he was Peter Parker. About a year later, he made a deal with the devil to erase that and his marriage to his wife. And comic fans still aren't over that.
It may sound like Ben's being flippant by saying a deal with the devil. Literally, a deal with Mephisto, the devil. So
I'm gonna get on this now. I think that storyline is badly told, but I think that all the changes that were made in that story have been for the better for Spider-Man for the last decade. Yeah, I don't think.
I think I've read it. You probably even linked me to it, but depending on how badly the changes are needed, it dictates how big of a change comic book fans are willing to accept, or how big of a retcon. And yeah, a world where people know Peter is Spider-Man is not a great Spider-Man world, so...
Yeah, it's a part of the thing where, like, Pete Parker is intrinsically, like, he's unlucky in love, and a story where he's happily married. It's nice, but, like, there's less story to tell there if he's coming home to Mary Jane at the end of it every single day, and she's always in danger because she knows who he is and stuff like that. It's like, no.
That's why he wrestles with it in the first... Like, he's constantly just fretting that his aunt and his girlfriend and his friends are going to find out. And it's like... You know, it's obviously, like, the biggest reveal they could have done. So it made for, like, high drama, but it just wasn't a good decision for ongoing continuity.
Yeah, it's like the three big things that happen in this series, which are Spider-Man unmasking himself, Iron Man becoming the de facto head of S.H.I.E.L.D. and a villain and stuff like that, and Cap dying, which doesn't happen in the miniseries, but does happen in tangent with the event, are all undone within about a year or two.
Cap never died.
Captain America and Batman died in a very similar way.
They really did. They a very displaced.
Similar amount of time. Yeah, that's all the breath I'm willing to give to Civil War. There was a sequel they did tie in to this movie, which isn't as good and it's did a lame. Similar thing.
It's just really lame. It's just not good times. I read it in like one sitting and I did not enjoy it a huge amount.
Basically, this movie takes the interesting framework that exists within Civil War and makes it into such a better concept. This movie is leaps and bounds better at telling a story about superhero Civil War than this comic book is. The artwork's pretty. There's a lot of famous scenes from the comic book that bleed into the movie because you can't have this film without the Iron Man and Cap clashing against each other's shields and energy blasts at the same time because that's just a badass shot. But I mean, we don't have the Thor robot, we don't have them accidentally killing Goliath, we don't have they built a prison in the negative zone, don't have Iron Fist dressed up as Daredevil.
Why not, damn it?
Spitting in Tony Stark's face.
We don't have Cloak and Dagger trying to, like, smuggle kids off the streets before they're shot dead by S.H.I.E.L.D.
We don't have Punisher.
Murdering Spider-Man. Almost.
The book's a mess. It's a total mess. And this movie is so much better than the book it's based on. And I'm so glad that Kevin Feige managed to fix it.
Doesn't it conclude with Cap just being like, hey, dude, look at all of this. And then Tony's like, you know what? You're right. Everyone, stop. Just call it off. I was wrong.
Yes,
my bad.
Yes, it does. That is how it ends. And then
bullshit.
Cap gets shot by Red Skull.
He does. Right, well, that's enough about that inferior comic book. Let's talk about this superior movie. And I'm just going to move through it because there's some pretty clearly defined chunks. And within those are some good times. So it's been a year since the events of Age of Ultron. Cap is leading a new squad of Avengers.
New Avengers, some would say.
Some would say, but not officially in the title of a film yet, because they're saving that one. They are on the trail of Crossbones. Hey guys, remember Crossbones? Or Brock Rumlow? He's back, guys. Frank Grillo, don't you worry. He's stolen a bioweapon from, is it Lagos in Africa they're meant to be?
It is in Africa because it's where the Wakandans are going on like a peace treaties. Yes. And they haven't actually left Wakanda that far. They just kind of crossed the border.
Yeah. And so they are on this little mission. They're fighting Crossbones and his dudes. It's all very badass. But then right towards the end, Crossbones mentions Bucky's name and that makes Cap freeze. He pulls the pin on a grenade. Scarlet Witch surrounds it in a little telekinetic bubble and throws it away, but then it blows up a building and kills a number of people, many of them Wakandan. Yeah, it's pretty fucking heavy stuff. So, you know, in this first early little bit, it's a pretty cool opening scene. It in much like Winter Soldier started strong with like a cool mission, this one is as well. Everyone gets to do their shit. Like Cap is running around being all gymnastic. Scarlett Johansson is back as Black Widow. Obviously, she sounds really knowledgeable when she's kind of giving Scarlet Witch a bit of a dressing down about what she needs to look out for. It's very effective. Anthony Mackie's got his little drone called Red Wing, which is a nice nod to his actual pet Falcon in the comics. He just seems... I mean, Anthony Mackie is always confident, overconfident in life, I would say, but as a character, he seems like he's got more sort of confidence and agency than he has done before. So even though he is kind of reduced to just standing next to Cap and going, yeah... He just seems like more of a character this time around than Winter Soldier. And Scarlet Witch, I really like that she's just sitting there in casual clothing because she's not like a full Avenger yet. And then, like, the ways she uses her powers during this mission, like removing gas from a room, levitating, throwing Cat through a window, it's all really, really good stuff.
She's a good support role, which I like. She's not the heavy, she's not, like, Cap's the one that's going to go in there and punch some people in the face and stuff like that, whereas Scarlet Witch is the one who stays behind and helps, essentially, which doesn't belittle position, but it's like it's really important to what the team is doing.
It's kind of what Tony wants Spider-Man to be doing when he comes in later. It's like, stay at a distance and web everyone. And for her, it's like, stand back, protect people if they're going to get shot, you know, help us out when you can, but we're going to be the ones going in and doing the getting our hands dirty. It's a fun little team, and like they all complement each other really well, and they combine abilities really well, which always goes down well with me. And then,
do you find it interesting we don't get Vision or War Machine?
Yes, in this War Machine opening. And yeah, they were both part of Cap's little team at the end of the previous one, but I guess that was just right. Who have we got? Chuck them in, because yeah, they are not here, either of them. Vision is the really interesting one, because why wouldn't he be? You get that Rhodes has like ties to the government still, and like he's got day-to-day responsibilities, but I don't know why Vision isn't here.
The tone of the scene is basically the three characters who were in Winter Soldier, and then Scarlet Witch is like the progenitor of the event that happens at the end of it. Yeah. But it is like, this isn't the full Avengers team, this is just a couple of them, which, I mean, when they have the meeting after this, like, I think it lends to a more interesting, like, rotating team that doesn't really get touched on. Yeah. Like, because you've got, like, Tony's there, even though Tony's, like, quote-unquote retired from this kind of thing.
He's next. But, yeah, I do like this idea that... Because that's the idea when, at the end of Age of Ultron, when they move into that new facility, it gives... Rather than just operating out of Tony's, like, skyscraper, it's just like, okay, here's a whole support staff... We got good resources, we got a rotating cast of heroes, Cap's in charge of the away teams. It gives that really good sense. But yeah, I really like this little unit. I like that they're sort of training Scarlet Witch, and everyone's pretty badass. And like that moment where she... I think it's really well executed when she chucks the grenade, but then ends up killing a bunch of people. It's like a very good demonstration of her powers, because you've seen her be so badass in the preceding like few minutes, and like the creative ways she can do things with it. And then obviously in the comics, it's like she's so powerful she can like break reality, and you're not going to do that in a movie probably. But this is a good example of how she has all this power, but she isn't necessarily in a tremendous amount of control of it. And it's a very heavy kind of moment where it's like, oh shit, she just killed a bunch of people.
Yeah, but I think that's one of the things that makes this movie more interesting than some other superhero fare that came out at the same time, is the the willingness to grapple with the idea of collateral damage and stuff like that. And they have shown these heroes saving people in previous movies, and obviously like public safety is obviously still at the forefront of their minds when they do these kind of missions, but there's always going to be casualties, and the movie doesn't shy away from that fact.
No, nor should they. And yeah, it makes it, even though it's so fantastical, it keeps it all very grounded. People like to sort of dismiss the MCU as like so joke heavy and quip heavy and like a little bit too silly, but they do all of this like really good stuff. Like, they have it both ways, and I don't think they get enough credit for the amount of drama they've sort of put in throughout the years. So meanwhile, while they're doing this, as you said, Tony Stark is basically retired as an Avenger. He is announcing a scholarship program to some students at MIT, where he's basically giving them unlimited funding to do research that, you know, wishing he had that stuff when he was their age, I guess. After he's finished speaking, he is confronted by the mother of a boy who was killed in Sokovia due to the actions of the Avengers. So Robert Downey Jr. is back as Tony Stark, and we get this mesmerizing scene with him de-aged digitally to look like he did in his I guess 20s. John Slattery is back as his father. Hope Davis debuts as his mother. Both of those actors within 2 years of age of Robert Downey Jr., but obviously he's being de-aged. It's incredible looking at that. Like, it is a absolutely perfect rendering of a young Robert Downey Jr. as he interacts with his mother, who he clearly loves, and his father, who he has this very cold relationship with. And it's just really fascinating. And like, she's playing that song on the piano where the lyrics talk about September, and then the name of the foundation that he starts is the September Foundation. It's a very nice little touch.
I will say, it's facially he looks fantastic, if a little uncanny valley, because the technology is still fairly new. But it's just weird watching Robert Downey Jr. try to act like a teenager or like someone in their early 20s, like, because his body language is very much not that. And so like the bit where he like goes and like,
I'll just fold my arms.
Yeah, I'm just like, what is that? That's what?
Yes. I like that on the teleprompter it's like I think it says something about how he hands over to Pepper, and then he just has that moment where he looks really sad, and he's like, oh, go break some eggs, and we get this little, oh shit, they've broken up off screen, essentially. Who comes over to him to sort of try and get some money but Jim Rash of Community, the dean.
Oscar winner Jim Rash.
Indeed, indeed. The Descendants, right?
Yes.
In my headcanon, he is the dean of MIT, but they just... All we know is he is a member of faculty, but... And then he is confronted, of course, by...
Roy Dillard.
Yes, Alfred Woodard, who is in Luke Cage. She's playing Miriam Sharp. Robert Downey Jr. got her cast because he'd worked with her before they clocked on that she'd just been announced as cast for Luke Cage. So, fuck you, Jeff Loeb, I guess. It is one of the few examples of characters having dual roles in the grand canon of everything. In a perfect world, I'm sure they'd rather they hadn't doubled up, but it's such a small scene, and she's so memorable as Mariah that it's fine. It's a good little confrontation of Tony.
It does lead to the question of, in 30, 40 years' time, when people are rewatching these movies, are they necessarily going to be going, and now I'm going to dive into the Netflix series at the same time that they came out in order? I don't think there's going to be that many people who are doing the whole MCU with TV shows in the future.
While all those shows are technically part of the canon of the MCU, that's a polite courtesy extended by Disney, I think, more than Kevin Feige doesn't give a shit about the storylines of the Netflix verse. Tony is confronted by this woman who has lost her son. It is mirroring what happens in the comic where a woman spits in his face at her son's funeral. I think she's got a similar name to Miriam. Is it Lillian? I don't know. Fuck that comic. He has this now weighing on his mind, and who shows up to Avengers HQ but Thaddeus Ross? William Hurt is back. The longest break between appearances in the MCU.
Secretary of the State.
I know, Thaddeus. What a job. Yeah, he turns up. And he basically tells the Avengers, on behalf of the government, the Sokovia Accords, named, of course, after the city... country.
I think it's one of those bits where it's like Luxembourg, where the capital of Luxembourg is also Luxembourg, so the capital of Sokovia is also Sokovia.
Maybe. Yeah, basically, it will call for the team to fall under supervision of the UN. Not register their identities publicly or any of that stuff. It's just you will have a overgoverning committee of various UN representatives who will tell you when and where you're going to do things. It's a very short, simple scene, but I think it's really, really well done. William Hurt coming back is incredible. The Russos wanted to acknowledge that The Incredible Hulk actually happened.
Only people that wanted to acknowledge that movie for anything but the scene where someone gets kicked into a tree.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful stuff. William Hurt likes to say this is a new vision of the character. He doesn't even consider it the same one. That's because you were playing a fucking cartoon character the first time around, bro. Nice to see him come in and not be completely awful. Because they grew their fan base over time. They became Marvel. So I don't know how many people were like, oh my god, Thaddeus Ross is back. But it's an actor of esteem to come in and play that role of the bad guy giving them this dressing down.
I was definitely one of those people that had a double take when they announced his casting. I was just like, wait, what? Yes. They hadn't acknowledged the movie for 7 years. Literally no one from that movie has returned. The character got a slight redesign in between Incredible Hulk and the Avengers in terms of Hulk. But it's just the most obvious acknowledgement of that movie.
One of the only ones. So yeah, around this table, we obviously have Cap and his new little team. Tony's there. And Don Cheadle is back as Rhodey, as War Machine. It's a much bigger role than he had in Age of Ultron, obviously, and him having that military past, it makes perfect sense that he would immediately be like, yeah, this is a good idea, of course we should sign up for this right away. And you have these arguments straight away where Black Widow is shockingly for it, and Tony's like, wait, what? Vision, as a creature of relentless logic, is in favour of it. As a side note, it is lovely seeing Vision dressed in all these expensive sweaters doing his impression of a human. I think that's really, really fun. I think it's really fascinating because if you've listened to this podcast, I think one of the more interesting things to track over time is the growth of Tony Stark as a human being. I think it's very interesting to note that this might legitimately be the first time in his life at age, I don't know, mid to late 40s, early 50s, that he's ever considered that a governing body would know best. You consider his circumstances, that this is his latest attempt to be a good person and to atone for his past. and it's the next evolution of what he was trying to do with Age of Ultron. It's like, right, okay, I tried to make a giant AI robot that was going to keep us all safe. That didn't work. Okay, I'm going to sign up with the government. I am the most government guy in the world now. Let's do this. It's just, it all makes sense as you follow him through these movies.
Yeah, it's weird. I think Tony's arc makes sense over all the movies, but it's weird to come into this one and have it be so utterly divorced of the context of him creating Ultron.
Well, like, yeah, we talked about how a lot of his actions in Age of Ultron are not addressed later on. He's in the same room as the Scarlet Witch, and there's no real reaction there. But
his reaction obviously is like, we contributed to the death of many people in Sokovia, and obviously like he blames himself somewhat for that. But the movie never comes out and says, because he created Ultron.
Yes, that's true.
it's this weird thing where, like, obviously it makes sense that they're not going to come out there and talk about that, because they can talk about locations, but, like, they want to leave the movie to be slightly standalone.
Yeah.
And getting into the villain of the previous movie and stuff like that.
Not time for that.
So Tony's arc makes sense, but it's just weird that there's no acknowledgement of it in terms of, like, why that would also be a big contributor to his seeming heel turn from where he was at the start of Age of Ultron to where he is at the start of this movie, even though the movies have done a really good job of tracking that point A to point B, even without the examination of what is going on in his head quite as much as you want it to be.
If we do get some time travel stuff, I really hope we get Tony having to look at Ultron and actually have to acknowledge it all out loud. I like them being shown like these video clips from locations around the world, and Ross doesn't need to say anything. He's just like, this is the place, and then you see all the violence and destruction that's happening. And it's really interesting because, like, you look at the final scene of the Avengers, or the big action scene towards the end of the Avengers, and it's like, oh cool, they're all running around doing shit. And then you consider, right, Hulk's jumping from building to building, you're standing street level, he jumps into a building. What if like a piece of that building fell and crushed you to death? You don't consider that while you're watching that scene, but they manage to ground that and make it all very serious, and that, like, yes, they are saving lives, but they are also undoubtedly causing massive amounts of destruction.
Yeah, I think we're coming into a stage now where three of the movies in this phase are all dealing with the repercussions of stuff that happened in previous movies, because you've got, this movie is obviously like so heavily indebted to the events of the previous kind of Avengers movies. Spider-Man Homecoming has a hell of a lot of stuff to do with the events of Avengers. Thor Ragnarok obviously dealing with the ideas of Hulk in Age of Ultron, and even Black Panther is kind of like semi-dealing with stuff from this movie as well. And so this is where stuff to really starts to get interconnected to other stuff. Like, this is where it begins to get a bit hard to start jumping into an MCU movie without additional context of the previous movie.
Yeah, like, they've done all their origins, they've built things up, they've gotten it to a level of excitement and like public awareness of who these characters are. And now, rather than like raising the stakes, I mean, and obviously Infinity War is like the fate of the entire universe, but in a lot of ways, rather than going bigger, they're just exploring the consequences of what's already happened. And I think that is tremendously to their benefit. I like that they acknowledge that Hulk is missing with that line about, you know, do you have any idea where Dr. Banner is? Because if I mislaid a nuke or whatever, if my job would be gone.
I think they go like, do you know where Thor and Hulk are? Or like, do you know where Thor and Banner are? And it's like, both of those are big things to be floating in the wind. They know what Asgardians can do, even if they don't show Greenwich. There's still probably footage they could show from Greenwich and be like, this is what happened when none of you showed up who are controlled by the government.
Yeah, and also Loki instigated the Battle of New York, so I mean, I'm sure they do know the difference between a Chitauri and an Asgardian, but from their perspective, an Asgardian led this army, so Thor is potentially dangerous. I think that's all really good stuff. Like, if you just gave like the single line pitch about this movie, it's like, oh, they're gonna have a huge fight because of they disagree about this. It's not about that. It's because, as we'll see in these next few scenes, it starts as just a difference of ideas with no real threat of violence, and it's just, it gets to such a point where, right, I'm taking Bucky, you will have to stop me. And they do, or they try. They do a good job of ramping up the level of disagreement from this point of just initial, like, here's what I think about the Sokovia Accords, to just, you know, what happens in Vienna, which is what we're going to talk about next, and then, you know, just going from there.
Because I went to see this with a friend when it came out. Most of us have seen all the Marvel movies and stuff like that, and we were really hyped for it. He was the only one who hadn't gone to see a Marvel movie since Winter Soldier came out. And he had some, like, big issues with the fact that Age of Ultron is kind of required viewing for this movie.
Well, I mean, yeah, we talked about that. Like, no matter how messy it is, I ran down that list of repercussions and what it all feeds into. So, yeah, it very much is a required viewing mess.
It's weird, though, because, like, this is... I would stand and say, like, this is the best trilogy in the MCU, is the Captain America movies.
Without question. But
it's also the only one where I would imagine that watching of one of another movie is required to get anything out of it, because who the fuck is Vision? Like, if you go from Winter Soldier to this movie, you can more or less figure out who a lot of the other characters are. The big purple guy who talks like Paul Bettany...
We still don't know who Vision is.
We still don't know.
We don't know who he is.
But he is such an outlier and such a, like, different thing to anything else in this movie that it's so weird that he's there. And I love that he's here, and I love that he's as an important part as he is, but it is one of those things where they do nothing to explain in this movie who exactly or what exactly he is beyond a talk about a stone that's embedded in his head.
That's very true. So yeah, several days later at the signing of these accords in Vienna. Meanwhile, like, Cap stops off to Peggy's funeral, which is very sad.
God.
But there's a bombing at this signing, which kills T'Chaka, the King of Wakanda, and security footage will later show that Bucky Barnes was responsible. So Steve goes to bring Bucky in by himself, against everyone else's wishes. They end up fighting each other, the authorities that have come for him, and T'Chaka's son, T'Challa, the Black Panther. So we got John Carney here as T'Chaka. He taught Chadwick Boseman some, I don't know how to pronounce it, Zosha, I don't know, the language that they speak, which is ostensibly Wakandan. He taught him a bit of that. Chadwick Boseman is making his MCU debut as T'Challa. He didn't audition, he just discussed with them what they would and wouldn't do. He signed a 5-picture deal. He developed his own Wakandan accent throughout, and he used that between takes, like, just the entirety of production, he spoke in this accent. Black Panther looks cool as fuck. I remember all the, like, promotional material coming out and just being like, right, I am the most excited. Obviously, you know what I'm the most excited for, but other than Spider-Man, the biggest, like, unknown new entity I am excited for is Chadwick Boseman as the Black Panther. And he's really fucking cool. And it made me very hype for the movie Black Panther, which, you know, we will get to in a few films' time. But their little scene together as father and son at the meeting, and, like, his little conversations with Black Widow, and then going out and being a superhero, all very, very cool stuff. And, like, the task of debuting in this movie is quite a daunting one, but I think he pulls it off.
Yeah, I think the movie does a really good job of developing a character who has to battle with two of the biggest characters in the MCU, but still gets to have, like, a story. It is interesting watching it, though, in the wake of Black Panther, and realizing there's a lot of little bits that haven't been developed yet. Like, the little bow and stuff like that isn't there, that little cross-armed kind of, like, thing that Wakandans do.
Wakanda forever.
Yeah, like, there's
and also, T'Chaka's, like, stance on global politics seems completely the opposite of what it is in Black Panther.
Yes, it does. But, like, I can't put anything against it. This is a supremely well done integration of a character into a movie. Obviously, Wakanda's had a lot of build up to showing up, like referencing Age of Ultron, the shields existed, and there have been, like, references to that and all kinds of other bits. And, like, Cap's aware of Wakanda when it comes up, and he, in terms of, like, his shield and stuff like that, and in terms of Howard Stark's relationship to Vibranium and stuff like that, like, there's all kinds of little bits that add up. There's a backstory that you can piece together from these movies before this character shows up, and it just kind of really adds that sense of, like, they have been building a world here, and they are aware that this character was always going to debut, and it's a good fit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of jumping ahead and we'll then come back, but just the scene where he, Bucky and Cap are sprinting down this road faster than cars, while it's goofy, it's pretty fun. And, like, that his claws can just cut through everything, and I don't know, it's just really good. It's a really good costume. They fucking nailed it, and then they got an even better one for his own movie, so go then.
I love that the shield has his claw marks in it.
Yes.
For the rest of the movie. It's, like, a really nice touch, is that anytime Cap shows it, like, he's got those claw marks just
Yeah, for sure. His anti-metal claws, or whatever they're called. So I mentioned Peggy's funeral. Very, very sad. Emily Van Camp is back as Sharon Carter. I guess she still exists, guys. That funeral speech she gives is lifted from a Spider-Man comic during Civil War, where Steve gives him advice on, you know, what the right thing to do is. It's a very good little speech, so it's a good idea to lift it and slightly modify it. And I think she's kind of... I don't know. Did Steve know before this moment that she was...
Not at all. Not like his reaction when he sees her at the funeral is 100% no idea. And then she does the little speech afterwards saying that, like, oh, I like to pretend that she's not my aunt, so I don't feel that I'm progressing through this agency because of who my aunt is. Yes. And like, it's 100% like they, in between movies, went like, we based this on Agent 13, but we'll make it explicit that this is Agent 13 in this movie in like in a kind of clumsy way, but in a way that makes it... I don't know, like, she has more to do in this movie by a hell of a margin, because she's not playing the one good... the character we know is going to be good in S.H.I.E.L.D., like, in the last movie.
Yeah, she works for the CIA now, doesn't she?
Yeah.
So, had you watched... I don't know what the timeline is here with Agent Carter and how much of it had come out and how much you'd watched, but, like, you know, this is the death of a character that we have celebrated again and again. But seeing this finally happen and Steve attending her funeral is a massive punch in the gut for me, and I haven't even seen all of Agent Carter, so I mean, I don't know if
Agent Carter wrapped up like 2 months before this episode aired, so like this was sad. Like, I appreciate that they find the time to do it, but I'm still kind of sad that they don't actually get time to have Peggy actually show up in this movie. It's very much she gets the news of the funeral and she's passing her sleep, and it's just like, oh, I'd have appreciated getting to see Hayley Atwell one last time in these movies.
Some sort of old recording they had of her or something that plays at the I don't know.
She's been in the last two movies in the MCU, so she's still obviously available to do stuff, and she's been in both the previous Cat movies, so it's a shame. I get why this movie's stuffed, but like, if I had to, I'd rather have Emily Van Camp not return and any screen time devoted to her given back to Peggy Carter, because even though ostensibly like Cap needs a love interest, even though I think that's kind of pointless and it should be Bucky.
We went over that, yes, that his relationships with other men are far more interesting than this, and even Black Widow, whether it's romantic or not. You say this, but to skip ahead a great deal, the scene where he finally kisses her and then it pans over to Falcon and Bucky in the car just sort of nodding and smiling is wonderful.
Is that Cap's first kiss?
Since being unfrozen,
because obviously, like, there's a big part of the internet that's like, Steve Rogers is a virgin.
Yeah. Is he privately just crushing ass? Well, I mean, obviously he kissed Black Widow for undercover purposes, but that might be his first romantic kiss since
the 1940s.
Yeah, and he kissed Marjorie Tyrell as well. What a guy. Okay, so Bucky, Sebastian Stan is back as Bucky Barnes at his most beautiful so far. He is fluent in Romanian. I didn't know this. He was born in Romania. So when he's speaking Romanian in that very brief scene, that's all very accurate, and he's buying plums because allegedly those help with your memory. Who knew? He talks about how this character is no longer Bucky, he is no longer the Winter Soldier, he is somewhere in between. I read an article like yesterday that he's actually going to be called the White Wolf in Infinity War, which I'm not a fan of, but he is back, and him and Cap just talking in that kitchen and then knowing that they are about to both get taken any second, but like Cap just wants to get through to him, and then Cap like trying to stop him from killing any of these dudes, but then also trying to knock them out himself, and it's all really, really well done. And like Bucky punching through the floor to grab a bug out bag, but you think he's like trying to kill Steve or something. It's all really, really well done, and like this like three-way chase, as I said, is great stuff. Like, you've got all these elements in play where you're not entirely sure what you want the outcome to be.
Yeah, it's one of those things where like I really appreciate how the start of this scene is pretty much like beat for beat something that could have been in Winter Soldier.
Uh-huh.
Walking into the house and like Falcon on the headset kind of like giving him the countdown to when the SWAT team's going to come in and everything like that, and then they're outside and then Black Panther shows up and you boom, superhero movie, and like they're running through the streets and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger as it goes along without breaking the realms of reality.
Yeah,
there's nothing like in Winter Soldier where when he jumps out of the S.H.I.E.L.D. headquarters and like he takes down the Quinjet like in about 2 seconds.
I love how much you hate that scene.
It's just so pointless.
I know.
but like in this movie, like all the little flourishes like that all kind of feel necessary. Like the bit where Bucky knocks the guy off the motorcycle, grabs the handles, flips it out underneath him, and then starts going again immediately. It's just like, what?
So cool. So cool. And like every time they fight each other, Winter Soldier and Black Panther, you don't know whose side you're on. The part of you that wants Cap's best friend to be his best friend again is like, oh no, you can't kill him. But then it's like, oh, Black Panther's really cool, and Winter Soldier's a great big murderer. So I don't know. And I really like their fights. Like this, they do a really good job of like conveying the ferocity of how hard Black Panther is coming at him, and that what Bucky, like, he kind of wants to leave all this behind, but if someone comes for him, he will fuck them up. Like, and he's like, leave me alone, like aggressively leave me alone. So I really like the way those two fight.
I think it is interesting also that, like, even though me as an audience member kind of realised that Bucky probably didn't do this.
Yes. Well, we'll get into that soon. But yeah.
We will. But like, we're at a point where there's no evidence that he didn't do it.
Exactly. Yeah. Because you see the video and you're like, oh, Bucky. Weird.
Yeah. So it's not like they can actually sit down and just talk to T'Challa, because T'Challa's doing like honor killing and stuff like that. And there is no evidence otherwise. And obviously you're hoping that they can find evidence otherwise, but like, you're still watching someone come after who they think quite legitimately murdered his father,
mm-hmm.
which I think is like, the key thing this movie does is like you get the reasoning behind why everyone is doing everything, yeah. which is so key to making this feel balanced.
You don't have to like send Thor off to a cave to splash around. Like, everyone has a reason to do what they're doing, like you said. So, I mean, I haven't spoken about him yet, because I mean, he pops up sort of every 10 minutes just doing a small something off to the side. But after these three are all captured, we see Helmet Zero, played by Daniel Brühl. He has stolen a book containing the trigger words that activate Bucky, which we see in the sort of prologue of the film. One of the few films to have a kind of cold open style thing. He infiltrates the facility where they are all being held, and he activates Bucky and sends him on a rampage. Cap is able to subdue him, but then he goes rogue and sort of sneaks him out with the help of Falcon. So there's a lot happening in this sort of 15-minute stretch of the film, including the debut of Martin Freeman as Everett T. Ross, I assume no relation to Thaddeus Ross. So he's really just there to kind of set up his future role in Black Panther. He's fine, I guess. I mean, now you don't have S.H.I.E.L.D., you've just got like the literal CIA, and he is your kind of Nick Fury stand-in, but not as capable, I guess. And in a film that's very busy, to have him debut as well, it seemed a bit strange, but it's not egregious because he's in it for like, I don't know, 4 or 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's one of those weird things where this is a role that could have been played by almost anyone, and obviously like they've now positioned him to be the Nick Fury of Phase 3 and Phase 4 and stuff like that, from like what the implications are from his role after Black Panther. But it is just weird that like they show up, it's like, oh, it's Martin Freeman, and then he's gone.
yes for sure. You've got Cap and Tony having one of their many wonderful little exchanges where, you know, Cap is a prisoner of these people right now because of his actions, but Tony's still like, look, this all goes away if you just sign. And like, he's presenting him with a pen that FDR used, and you know, all these things. And it's just that one little turn of phrase sets Cap back against him, and the whole, you know, sometimes I want to punch you in your perfect teeth, like, it's all just so well done, I think. And it will just continue to build from this point.
And it's also good in that it's been there since their first interaction in the Avengers. Like, this isn't
immediate disdain and, like, you know, like, who the fuck are you? And, like, resenting how much his dad talked about him and all this stuff. I think he even says in this one, like, oh, it's never come up. Yeah, and obviously Black Panther, kind of with his diplomatic immunity, he's kept off somewhere like a little bit nicer than where they all are. That's all fun as well. But yeah, Daniel Brühl is the villain of this film. And it feels strange to even say that, because I mean, obviously all these movies have to have a villain, but he's a very different kind of villain. And the key conflict is between the two sides. And yes, he is stoking the fire because he has no superpowers. He is not enhanced in any way whatsoever. He isn't like an elite soldier. I mean, he was part of the Sokovian army or whatever, but he's not meant to be like an elite soldier or anything.
Yeah, he at no point tries to fight the Avengers.
Yeah, and he even acknowledges that he couldn't. He's just a normal guy, and he manipulates them all. He's loosely related to a character in the comics, like to Baron Zemo. I think there even is a Helmet Zero in the comics, but I don't think he's supposed to
be. There is a Helmet Zero in the comics.
Yeah, I don't think he's supposed to be a literal version of him, but yes. I think it's a really really good performance, and it's just that there's so much else going on that he isn't able to have enough focus, because he's not like a flashy actor anyway. Like, he's a very sort of understated kind of guy. I think it's great. It's great to have something different for once, that this is just a guy who's just exploiting what is there for him. And it's not a situation where as soon as they realize he's behind it all goes back to normal, because he hasn't fabricated this. He is just sort of pushing it in the right directions. Like, the conflict, as you said, has been there from day one between these two. So I think he's great, and like, you get all these little scenes with him like finding the Hydra agent and like drowning him in a sink, and then like taking the identity of this psychiatrist and murdering him in his bathtub and all that stuff. It's just a good little creeping villain. It's just maybe he gets a little bit lost in the shuffle, because people, when they talk about like the best villains in Marvel, I mean, I guess we could just do Villain Watch now in some ways, but obviously this guy isn't going to be like one of the heavy hitters when you compare him to like the likes of Loki and Killmonger and those sorts of people. But it's a good performance, and like, it's a solid villain. You understand his motivations, and he gets a complete arc, and it's not generic in any way, I don't think. So I think he's like a dark horse candidate to be right up there with the best villains they've done. It's just there's so much else going on.
I think he's good, and I think the motivations are all there, but again, he's not villainous in the same way that you get from these comic movies, and that's really appreciated. But even when you get the revelation of like what he's doing the whole time, Tony's immediate reaction isn't to go after him, it's to go after Bucky. So I think that's where the important distinction lies, is he's kind of more in line with an Arnim Zola in terms of like, he's pushing something to go this way, but there's not enough there to kind of like elevate him above that. They put in the stuff with him and the answer machine message, which you don't get the context for until the very end, and he's one of the few Marvel villains who is still out there at the end. Like, he's still available to come back in and do some stuff, but it's very much like he is a plot progenitor before he's a character, and I think that's what kind of holds him back from that top level, is that like, if the movie had done more with the stuff with his family and all the rest of it, then maybe I would feel a bit more strongly about it. But it's very much like, he murders a bunch of people, does some really interesting stuff in what he does to the Avengers, but the emotional context after the emotional revelation we have like 2 minutes beforehand, his emotional revelation doesn't hit quite as hard, I feel. And that's mostly a difference of the characters we've been following for 13 movies versus the character who's shown up in this first one, kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying he's someone you should feel strongly about. It's just, when you consider how many of these characters are like sloppily or hastily executed or rushed, or they might even actively detract from the film, this is a tidily executed villain with understandable motivations, and it's not like you're clamoring for loads more scenes to like flesh him out more. It's like, you get it, he came in, he gave a good performance, he got out. And I'm never gonna say he's like, oh, actually guys, I think he might be the third best villain. It's just, I think he is completely not spoken of because of everything else that happens here. But
anyway, I think he's better than any villain we had in phase two. I mean, Ultron's the only one who, yeah, I would consider close, but like, he's better than the villain of Iron Man 3, Thor: The Dark World. He's better than Pierce, he's better than Ant-Man, and he's better than Guardians of the Galaxy. So
I like the ongoing fight scenes that you have here. Like, you have Black Widow against Winter Soldier, and she says the thing about, you could at least remember me, which you could take many different ways, because I mean, A, she fought him in Winter Soldier. B, in Winter Soldier she said that she was shot by him. So there's that. And then there's even, I mean, she doesn't acknowledge it in Winter Soldier, but there is a little moment towards the end where there's a drawer in the facility, this Hydra base where like they developed Winter Soldier, that is marked Romanoff. And obviously in the comics, I think their pasts are more tied together. So it's some nice little acknowledgement there. And Tony didn't bring his Iron Man suit because he's sort of retired as Iron Man, but he's got that little watch glove thing, which is very, very cool. Some really good stuff. And right, of course, the money shot for this movie. Steve stops a helicopter taking off by doing a bicep curl, and
he stole my loins.
I know. Tom Hiddleston's favorite MCU scene, apparently. Chris Evans legitimately injured his arm doing this because he flexed too hard, and he arrived on set wearing a big jacket, and they're like, no, take that off. I also learned that the wardrobe department always get him t-shirts two sizes too small, just so he's always just ripped. And they have to film all these scenes at the beginning of production because he loses a ton of weight filming scenes in the suit because it's so like hot and everything. So anything that requires him to be buff as fuck is filmed early on. But yes, he does a fucking bicep curl, the helicopter, in a scene that is not... See, I mean, obviously the helicopter is CG'd, but that is his real arm. No one is touching that up.
Give me a minute. I'm just watching the scene again.
Okay. Please don't masturbate on microphone.
Wait, it's about to happen. Oh my god. Like, you've seen the names.
It's insane. It is an insane, insane scene. I don't know what else can be said. He does a bicep curl with a helicopter.
There are so many money shots in the trailer.
I know.
Like, in the multiple trailers that come out. But this is... I feel like this is the most enduring shot from this movie. Like, the amount of times that I have sent this GIF or seen this GIF being sent to other people is astounding.
Sorry, stop the podcast. You say GIF, not GIF?
Yeah.
Wow, okay. I'm not sure we can keep going, but we will.
I'm going for what the creator of the thing says, so...
Oh, damn it. By that logic, I have to agree with you. So Cap escapes with Bucky, with Falcon. Bucky reveals to them that Helmet Zemo framed him, used the brainwashing to get the location of... When he came in and said the words to him in the facility, because he, like, used a pinch, which... You know, Don Cheadle in two movies with pinches to knock out all the surveillance. He had sort of 5 minutes alone with Bucky, with him under his control and everything. He learned the location of the Hydra facility. And big reveal here, there are 6 other Winter Soldiers in cryostasis, or maybe 5, I don't know.
I think it's 5.
Yeah, I think there's 6 in total, but there's 5 more there. But Cap and Falcon obviously do not have the numbers to contend, so Falcon knows the guy, and in they bring Ant-Man. They manage to talk Hawkeye out of retirement. He goes to get the Scarlet Witch. We will be talking about all of this in their attempt to sort of get Bucky to this facility and stop it and everything. They are intercepted at Leipzig Airport by Tony, who of course is flanked, as we would expect, by War Machine, by Vision, shockingly, as we know, by Black Widow. T'Challa, because it's convenient, because he hates Bucky, is on their side. And Tony has recruited one Spider-Man. So, this is, like, the stretch of the film in a lot of ways. Although, you know, you and I think, like, what's going to happen after this more. But this is the headline stuff. So, straight away, Paul Rudd as Ant-Man. Him fangirling Cap is genuinely amazing to me. Like, him just like, oh, hey, oh, hi there, and like, oh, I know you too. You're cool. But anyway, Cap, hey.
How much do you reckon Paul Rudd was on set? Because obviously he's the only one with like a full face mask in this fight. And it's just one of those things where like, I feel like he literally does 3 scenes, which is this one, the scene where his mask comes off at the end of the fight, and the scene in the prison at the end, and the rest is voiceover, because they didn't need Paul Rudd on set for all of this. Like,
no, but still. He obviously in the fight gets to be Giant Man, which you and I work in a place, or did work in a place, that sells merchandise for these kind of things, and I distinctly remember getting the Giant Man pop vinyls in and being like, oh, so I guess that happens then, because yeah, the movie hadn't even come out yet. Obviously, his role is a bit odd because of his power set, but he gets to have a lot of fun in that fight, I think, and the nice little Pinocchio reference, or the Finding Nemo reference, whichever you want to call it, when he's inside Tony's armor, he's like, I'm your conscience, we haven't spoken in a while. And when he grows big and he's Giant Man, he's like, it's just really dumb but funny that he's laughing that way and everything. And he rides on the arrow that Hawkeye shoots, and, you know, just lots of good fun stuff where, like, on paper you're like, sorry, Ant-Man versus all these guys, he's fucked. But it's like, nope, turns out he in some ways ends up being the biggest threat to that team when he becomes Giant Man. Paul Rudd, a lot of fun. Jeremy Renner as Hawkeye. It's a really nice moment because, I mean, we have to also tie this in with what's happening with Vision and Scarlet Witch. She attempts to leave the Avengers compound earlier in this film, and Vision is like, no, or we could just get a pizza or something. And it becomes very clear that she is, on orders of Tony Stark, not allowed outside anymore. I don't know if this was meant to be permanent or just until the accords were signed or what, but yes, Vision sort of becomes her house arrest warden. But at the same time, they are bonding and forming this little romantic link that is famously from the comics and based on the trailers for Infinity War is going to be taken a lot further. I think all of that stuff is really well done, as they bond over like the nature of their powers, and he gives that little speech about not knowing what the Infinity Stone does, and they are both so powerful but they don't fully understand certain things. I think all of that is really well done. And then when you get Hawkeye showing up, you're like, oh, of course Hawkeye's here. But as as I said, when we did Age of Ultron, I completely forgot that he's supposed to technically be retired. And he gets to briefly take Vision down with his little electro arrows, and he like goes to lead her away, and then he's reached the end of the room and she hasn't moved, and he sort of trots back and the music comes out, and it's a fun little scene with him showing up. And
I think it's fun that the growth of them realizing what they can do with Jeremy Renner as Hawkeye is very much appreciated, because we start with Thor where like he doesn't get to do anything, and then Avengers misuses him entirely, and then Age of Ultron they start to figure out what to do with him, and then this movie, like, there's a lot of really nice like little character beats with him, even if he's only in the movie for 3 scenes and stuff like that. The banter between him and Black Widow is is fantastic.
We're still friends, right? It depends how hard you hit me and stuff.
And then Black Widow coming up, Scarlet Witch coming along afterwards going like, you're pulling your punches,
because those two of course have the little bond, and that helps him like recruit her, in that like he's retired but he owes a debt or whatever, obviously, to Pietro, who's dead, and she obviously of course at first has accepted, yes, I'm too dangerous, and doesn't want to go, but then ultimately I think he gets through to her and she takes Vision down by forcibly making him go, because he can like move through walls and everything, so he can change his density, and he kicks Hawkeye's ass in the fight. I love that Hawkeye is still trying to fight him, like after the first punch attempt that whiffed, you'd surely just be like, oh well, I'll stop then. But of course he keeps trying to throw hands with him. Yeah, she forces him to go really dense and fall through the fucking earth, which is pretty extreme. Because of course he has the Mind Stone in his head, she got her powers from it, so I guess she is able to directly manipulate his powers, if it isn't just directly from her abilities already. But yeah, he's a lot of fun. And like, I like the little banter in the fight. I think Tony's like, didn't you retire? Like, shouldn't you be golfing or something? It's like, well, I shot 18. I played 18. That was it. I got a bit bored. Like, turns out if you just do Matt Fraction Hawkeye, it goes well. Tom Holland is Spider-Man, and yay.
Do I just leave you for this
Yeah,
one?
I guess you can just leave the room, go make a sandwich or something. I'm shocked that they revealed him in the trailer, but I guess it made sense to do it. Was it out there that they were doing it before they debuted that trailer where he shows up at the end of it? Or was that the announcement? Okay.
I think Tom Holland had been announced, or like the deal had happened.
Okay.
And so, but like they hadn't seen the suit and stuff like that. And then the last trailer before the movie came out debuted Spider-Man. But I think everyone was waiting for something. Like, I don't think it wasn't as big a deal as like the Apocalypse trailer that came out that ended with Logan.
Yes. Yeah,
so which was like, no one knew that was happening.
That was so unnecessary. That was such a, oh god, we need to get ticket sales up.
Yeah, whereas this one was like, it was like the last trailer, and it's like, everyone knows this is happening, let's give them a little something. Because you still don't see him do anything other than take the shield in the trailer.
Yeah, true.
But like, it is enough to like, basically have people go like, ooh, I'll go see I'll go see this for Spider-Man. Like, Spider-Man is still the king of like superhero box office, apart from Batman. Spider-Man is still that bums in seat character.
Yeah.
Which is why we get to a stage now where they delay Black Panther to speed track Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yeah.
And now Black Panther has completely dominated Spider-Man at the box office and all the rest of it. So But like, it's just that interesting thing, which is like, Spider-Man has always been a big deal, but now Black Panther has like usurped that role.
True. So he has a 6-film contract, 3 Spider-Man films, and it's phrased as like 3 solo films, but I don't know what you would call this. I wonder if it's 3 Spider-Man films and then 3 like MCU appearances. So I guess this would count as one of them. But yeah, he tested with Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Evans separately, and he had such good chemistry with them both individually that he was in. He made his audition tape for this alongside John Bernthal. They were both making a film together, and they just auditioned side by side to play Spider-Man and Punisher, and they both got it. I like that the first scene you see of him, he's got like the DVD player under his arm while he's walking away from camera, which sort of mirrors one of the earlier shots in Amazing Spider-Man where Andrew Garfield has a skateboard under his arm, because we had that lovely time where Peter Parker was a skateboarding hipster dude. It's a nice little nod. Like, I think Amy Pascal of Sony was sad that the Amazing trilogy or the Amazing series wasn't going to continue. Like, she liked Andrew Garfield a lot, but the problems were what they were, and as much as I think he did a good job, I think the decision to go younger was a good one. And when I heard that, I was like, oh god, like, who are they going to find? Turns out they found a fucking awesome Spider-Man. Tom Holland is a wonderful, wonderful young actor who the physical things he brings to the role are such an advantage. Like, it makes it all seem more authentic. I think the suit is really nice. I prefer it in Homecoming, because in this one it's entirely CG, I believe. Like, he was wearing a suit on set, but I think they just sort of replaced it entirely digitally and he just was doing voiceover. But yeah, he just comes in here, he debuts, they get it in a way that I don't think Raimi or Webb did, just instantly. He's quippy in the right way, like, he's not annoying, and the jokes still play, like, where he's fighting these characters and he's like, oh man, that's so cool the way you fly, like, that's so cool, and Falcon's like, I don't know if you've been in a lot of fights, but there's not normally this much talking.
I don't know if you've read them, like, but Kevin Feige had notes for Sony on Amazing yes. Spider-Man about, like, all the things they shouldn't do, yeah. And then they're all rules they broke, so, like, giving Spider-Man back to someone who, like, clearly likes and loves the character and mm-hmm. intrinsically knows what to do with these people is a good thing, and yeah. I think we're still to be seen on what happens with the rest of Sony's Spider-Man universe. We are two appearances in and it's good so far, but yes. we've got one solo Sony movie to come later on this year that yeah. is
I can't imagine a world where Venom is good, but you know, your move, Sony, your move, Tom Hardy.
So I do want to bring up one thing, which is Peter Parker doesn't know Star Wars.
Yeah, that old movie.
It's just one of those things where it's just like, I feel like he would have more knowledge or more appreciation for Star Wars than he apparently shows in this film.
It's all just to age him, you know, like, how old is this kid?
I know, but like, I get why they do it and I get why they reference Star Wars, but it's just one of those things where I'm just sat there going like, I feel like he would know Star Wars. I feel like the thing that would like do it better would be like if they referenced him doing it in a video game or something.
But then I feel that's a little bit too convoluted to be snappy.
No, true, but like, it's just like, oh, you know, this is like when I took down those at-ats in that video game, and it's just that kind of like that generational thing.
Oh, that he's
like
played it rather than seen it or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. I really love when he kicks Falcon and Bucky's asses and then they're both lying there or whatever, and Falcon calls in Red Wing to like knock him out of a window or something, and Bucky's like, you couldn't have done that 10 minutes ago. He's like, I hate you. I love this little three-way dynamic where, like, I feel we've all been in this situation where you are friends with someone, but you hate one of their other friends, and you just have to awkwardly all sit there together. And, like, when they're in the car that is way too small for these three hulking, muscular dudes, and it's just like, can you move your seat? No.
The dynamic between those two is really good, and I think the saddest thing about it is that Black Widow's on the other side, because we yeah. don't get to see how she reacts to this, because I feel like the three of Falcon, Cap and Natasha were like a really good team in Winter Soldier, and I would have loved to have seen the dynamic between the four of those
yeah.
in this movie as sure. like a progression of the sequels. I get why Black Widow's on the other team, but it's just one of those things where it's just like, oh, I really want to see how she would react in this situation with these, like, just the testosterone going on and like what her opinion of this dynamic would be.
So part of Spider-Man coming in is we have a new Aunt May. She has gotten 10 years younger, every actress that plays her. Marissa Tomei is our new Aunt May. And despite being in the film for 2 minutes, she had her own assistant during filming because she's Marissa Tomei. Oscar winner, don't you dare belittle her. Of course, Robert Downey Jr. and Marissa Tomei were a couple back in the day, and I think they play with that nicely, with basically hitting on her in front of Peter, who isn't thrilled about it. The little scene of the two of them in Peter's bedroom, where like he's trying to lie about being Spider-Man, and then just Tony just immediately guesses where the suit is, and oh, it's just so much fun. I think he nailed it as Spider-Man and Peter in a way that neither of his predecessors were capable of.
I still remember seeing it on like an opening night audience, and the Queen's
yeah.
big
oh,
text
yeah, yeah.
comes up
yeah.
and it's just the realization of like, that's where we're going is yeah. just like such a good moment of just being like, oh my god, they're doing it. It's so much more than I thought it was going to be. I figured it was going to be
a tiny cameo,
but like he has a setup, he has the fight, and then he gets the post-credit scene as
well. He does,
well.
Which is pretty shocking. And you mentioned Queens, like when he's fighting Cap, and he's like, oh, you got heart, kid, where you from? He's like, Queens. He's like, Brooklyn. And it just runs off. It's like a really nice little Cap moment.
One of the first times that we, like, outside of the TV stuff, get acknowledgement of New York as hub
yeah.
for an awful lot of...
It's not just one giant city. It's a regional thing. And I like in the post-credit scene when he's got the black eye, it's like, oh, some kid, Steve, did it from Queens. from Brooklyn, sorry. It's just a nice little way of doing it. And we'll see how incredibly well they utilize the Civil War thing in Homecoming. So this scene more generally, like, I think we've been over a lot of the bigger moments, but just generally generally speaking, this fight scene is one of, if not the best, sort of sustained action fight scene in a superhero movie. They shot it in Atlanta in, if you're in America, 90 degree heat. For us, that's 32 degrees, which is insane. And despite doing that, they replaced a large number of them with digital counterparts, so it sucks to be them. In the background of this airport is a Bluth Company Stecker, so fun little nod to the Russos. You can just see it like poking out at one point, but yeah, it's just really good. Like, we could just sit here and list every cool thing that happens in it, but it's just really good.
This is, more than anything, the thing that gets you most excited for what the Russos are going to do with Infinity War, because this is just pure superhero joy. This doesn't have the darkness that, like, some of the superhero fights on fights in Avengers had. There's tension, but you don't think anyone's going to die.
Yeah, they acknowledge it. More than one character is kind of, like, openly, like, this is kind of silly that we're doing this, but we have to. And, like, you know, Hawkeye and Black Widow fighting each other and just having quips in between. And, you know, the stuff with Spider-Man just, like, really not taking it all that seriously as he does it. It's almost like we have to do this so we can say we did it in some ways, where no one's looking to kill each other.
Yeah.
Until. So a big part of it is, like, who's fighting Vision, because they're going to lose. Like, you kind of lose track of where he is physically in the fight, because, you know, he could kick most of these people's asses. But where this leads to is, he is briefly distracted by the Scarlet Witch as this is happening. You've got Falcon in the air, you've got Cap has gotten to the jet because Black Widow lets him go, which is a fun little beat. Cap's in the air in a jet with Bucky, and Tony and Rhodey are trying to stop this jet getting anywhere, and Falcon is there as well. Vision is distracted, and Rhodey, like, tells him to snap out of it. He fires a laser towards Falcon. Falcon just avoids it, and it hits Rhodey right in the arc reactor. So he is falling out of the air in that suit with no power. And they do a really good job of conveying how scary that is. Like, you see the inside of the suit when all the fancy electronics aren't working. And it's just, you are so scared for him as he falls. And I'm still not convinced he would get out of this just paralyzed, given how far he falls. But yeah, he crashes into the ground. I like the Falcon. Immediately, his first instinct is to try and stop him hitting the ground, just to really layer in this thing that it's like they're fighting, but they don't want to kill each other. And obviously, you get Tony sort of cradling a greatly injured Rhodey, and he just immediately just shoots Falcon off screen when he tries to say anything. It's a really sombering moment, for sure.
Yeah, it's the little touches, like, you see Rhodey start to black out as he gets to the bottom of it,
right.
Which is, like, again, like a fairly realistic.
And as an experienced airman as well.
Yeah, and just, like, the fact that the music kind of cuts out and all you get is this, like, wide shot of Tony and Falcon coming in from the sides and just this thump of, like, as he hits the ground. And it's almost like a commentary on these superhero fights, which is, yeah, we can have the, like, spandex and fun and special effects, but there are people in here. And it's still one of those moments where, like, I genuinely thought they might have killed him. Yeah. For a second.
Yeah, for sure. Like, he is, at the end of this movie, like, doing rehab and everything. But yeah, he is at the least paralyzed, I think they say, in this. I think it's very interesting that Widow lets Steve go. Like, him and Bucky make it to the hangar, and the Scarlet Witch, like, just about, like, helps them get there and whatever. And then the one person blocking them is the Black Widow. Black Panther is behind them, and then she surprisingly shoots Black Panther and lets them go. Because, I mean, she doesn't know. She's been conflicted about this from the word go, but I just don't think she can bring herself to work against Cap. I think she believes that there's more going on than there is and everything.
Yeah, I like that she's the one that seems Cap wouldn't be fighting as hard for this as he is if he didn't have, like, a legit reason to do it. And the fact that he's going to a location as opposed to trying to hide and stuff like that, like, I think that is a really nice character beat.
And, like, I think with the, when the fight starts, I think Cap is, you know, it wasn't him, and Tony's just like, yeah, that's very convenient or whatever. So, I mean, I just think she knows him and that he doesn't lie. So, all really good stuff. So everyone except Cap and Bucky obviously gets taken into custody from that side of things. Tony goes to visit them in the raft, which is a sort of prison floating out in the ocean. He has basically learned at this point that Bucky wasn't responsible after all, so he goes to visit them in order to get Steve's destination, which is in Siberia. He shows up there, he forges a temporary truce with Cap and Bucky, but that is shattered into a billion pieces when they get to Zemo, and he reveals that Bucky murdered Tony's parents in a mission that we see at the beginning of the film, set in 1991. And because Howard had this super soldier serum replica, I guess, in the back of his car, Bucky got it, and they used that to make these other Winter Soldiers. Oh, by the by, Zemo just kills these Winter Soldiers. I love that as a reveal. They get there, and it's not that they're going to have to fight them all together. It's, nope, he killed them all. He's going to make
He killed them all because I don't want more people like you.
Yeah, exactly.
Walking around.
Of course not. And, like, they assume the worst, that, oh, he's going to set loose an army of Winter Soldiers. And, like, that's what you envision the second they reveal this information, that there are more of them.
And, like, we get so much more setup for them than you think we should. They do the whole thing, like, here's the training montage of them going evil and stuff like that. And, like, they're this threat. And in the back of your head, when you're watching the movie, you kind of go, oh god, are we really going to have to go through a tedious fight where Cap, Bucky, and Iron Man have to take down these five super soldiers in another twist on, like, ah, they're the hero, but the villain kind of thing. And then they walk in there and...
they're just dead.
Yeah.
Or just, like, with bullets in their head.
There's five holes in the glass, and you're just like, oh shit, this is not the plan. And the reveal that... I mean, like, because we've known that Winter Soldier killed Tony's parents. Like, it's revealed in Winter Soldier.
But still seeing Tony work through that, and, like, seeing the scene that we see at the beginning of Winter Soldier just doing a random mission, and then seeing it again through CCTV and seeing, like, you know, what am I looking at? What is this? Because he, of course, knows the road and everything.
Yeah, it's this, like, messed up bit where, like, because the death is done, like, he just punches him in the face twice with his metal arm, and then...
Oh, God, it's really brutal, though. Like, because you don't see him punch a person with that arm very much, if at all. He uses it primarily to block attacks and to, like, pound on, like, metal or whatever, but to see him just fully connect with a non, like, enhanced person's face, it's like, oh Jesus, it's so well done. So just very briefly before we get into that, I like that when he visits the Raft, Hawkeye refers to him as the Futurist, which is the name of a Robert Downey Jr. musical album. Isn't that fun? And he tells Scott Lang, he's like, who are you? And it's like, he just immediately just backs down. That's really fun. I also like that a consistent thing is that everyone other than Cap that has attempted some form of the Super Soldier Serum has displayed some level of insanity, as we saw when someone got kicked into a tree. Yes, we will bring that up in as many episodes as possible. My God, the fight scene that we get here, the level of brutality that is pretty unexpected. I mean, I don't remember if this was a 15 or a 12. I would imagine it was a 12 in this country. But they get away with a surprising amount, I think, without it going to such a level that it has to be a higher, like, age rating. But you get Bucky trying to, like, rip's face off almost. I don't know, it's just really savage, like, this fight.
We get this movie of, like, bright colours, superheroes punching each other, like, there's laser bolts everywhere, and then we get to this scene, and it literally becomes...
it's just a dark, like, abandoned Soviet silo, and just them just having a really ugly fight together. Where, like...
yeah, like, Iron Man recording what Cap's doing, and then figuring out how to take him down.
Yeah.
And, like, that little callback to, like, the first time we see Steve in Captain America, like, in the cinema and stuff like that, where, like, he has the fight afterwards, and then he, like, gets up.
I could do this all day.
I could do this all day. And then just these lovely little callbacks and stuff like that, and just you can see Robert Downey Jr. just acting his fucking heart out in this. Like,
that's the thing. This is the big thing for me, and one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast, in that you say whatever you want about the MCU, that they built so much emotional cachet over the years that they could execute this scene where... the line of, like, he killed my mom. I also like that it's her, it's not his dad. That, I mean, I'm sure he's angry that if he just killed his dad, but just that that's what it is for him. He killed my mom. And he's my friend, so was I. All this sort of stuff. At the end, when he's like, that shield doesn't belong to you, and demanding he drop it and everything. I challenge you to find a scene as, like, emotionally impactful in a superhero movie compared to this, when you consider everything that's gone into it. And did you know? Yes. And just so good. And, like, the fight is good as well. That's the thing. It's not just that they are saying all this, like, really poignant dialogue that hurts and wounds. It's that it's also a really cool fight where, like, they're gradually disabling Tony's suit, taking out one of his foot thrusters, slightly disabling guidance system, so he has to take the helmet off and shoot manually. Just all this really well done stuff. And, like, the two of them, like, fighting Tony together and like tossing the shield back and forth and just overwhelming him with attacks is also really, really good.
It's so well shot, and I love that scene where it's the two of them beating him up is just so well done and set up, and
it's just money.
Yeah, I like, it's one of those scenes where like this is what I think of when I think of this movie. Yeah. Is like the airport scene is terrific. It's the best superhero fight in a movie probably ever. Yeah. But like this is exactly what a superhero fight to kind of end a movie needs to be. There is emotional payoff here. It's not two CGI things punching CGI things in like a big fiery environment because one of the things is trying to kill the world. Like, it's all very much like these are three characters who have emotional reasons for being here, and you don't know whose side you're on. No. You want Winter Soldier to go away and get better, but on the other hand, you're just like, he did kill Tony's mum. Like, I can completely understand because we know this character and he has flights of emotion and he is like impulsive and all these other bits that you just get intrinsically.
And like, would Cap fight this hard if it wasn't his best friend? The question of what level of response in a real world setting, if this had happened, what would he be tried for it as the one who is culpable of these murders, or is the fact that he was literally brainwashed enough to exonerate him? It's a difficult thing, and I genuinely don't know how hard Cap would fight to. I think ultimately he wouldn't want him to be murdered by Tony in cold blood right there. But it's just, you've got so much at play, and it's what happens if you build a universe right and put the time into it, is you can do things like this. And you consider that they did, you know, Batman vs Superman came out less than a month earlier, and you just have these two characters, you just smushing two action figures together and saying, oh yeah, they're fighting, oh he just doesn't like him, fuck it. But this, it works, and you're behind everyone and you don't know what you want, and it's all just really difficult to swallow. Tony like shoots Bucky's arm off with the unibeam from the chest, because like Bucky has him like pinned against a wall and like cracks the repulsors in the hands, so, and it's like, oh god, he's gonna kill him. And then he fires that beam and there goes his arm again. He is the first character in Marvel to lose his arm twice. And he keeps the arm losing streak intact, and then it boiling down to Cap just having to go that far to stop Tony, embeds the shield in his arc reactor and shuts the suit down. But he rips the face mask off because he would have suffocated otherwise, because that is literally just an airtight metal suit otherwise. So, you know, to the end, he is not trying to kill him, but it is a visually very sort of uncomfortable thing to see, is him just like burying the heart of who Cap is, that shield, into the heart of who Tony is, this invention of his, this arc reactor.
And it's a lovely moment that, like, if this had happened before Iron Man 3, it would have killed him.
Indeed.
Like, it's one of those things where it's symbolic in more ways than one, because that was, until a few months ago, the only thing that was keeping him alive, and to destroy that is, ugh. Just this whole thing is so good.
It's the thing, like, I would want to talk about this all day because of just how important it is, but there's nothing we can say that's going to do justice to just watching it and considering everything that went into it. When he's, like, limping off with Bucky and Tony's like, you know, that doesn't belong to you, and he drops the shield, you've got your sort of money shot, and it's one of the, like, 20 money shots in this film.
The biggest one being when they pan across those kind of, like, cross beams and you get
the front cover of the comic, yeah.
The front cover of the comic, and it's so good.
They are adamant that Steve will never be Nomad, but they do want to give little winks and nods to that period of time where he had just become so disillusioned with the government that he just no longer was Captain America. But yes, he drops the shield, he's made his choice, off he walks. I believe for like the stretch towards the end of the film, the little A's on his arms are missing. He has them at the beginning when he's actively an Avenger, but, and I don't know what point they're gone, but I do know before the end of the movie, his little Captain America suit doesn't have the A's on the side, and it's a nice little touch. So you may be wondering what happened to the villain of this movie, Helmut Zemo, during all this. He essentially went outside and wanted to kill himself because he'd lost... It's a tragic little backstory that, you know, he's got this last voicemail from his wife and all this stuff. But T'Challa, who had followed them there to try and kill Bucky still, he learns the truth, and he also prevents Zemo from killing himself as well in order to bring him in. You know, it's a bit kind of like we wanted to do something with Black Panther other than he gets arrested or whatever, but it is also a bit just in comparison to what's going on downstairs, it's like, oh god, it's just nowhere near as impactful. But his little speech about, you know, not letting himself give in to rage, I think is a really good character beat that stays with him.
I think it's a nice conclusion to Black Panther and Zemo's story here is that neither of them feel intrusive, and obviously I'm more interested in what's going down below, but like the fact that there is time to kind of give them this little moment of, I'm not going to let you kill yourself because I sympathize with you, but like what you did is bad and we're going to let the authorities deal with you, is like a nice turn. He was ready to kill Bucky, and because what Bucky did would have been in cold blood if Bucky had done it, whereas this is like, you're hurting, I'm hurting, I see sympathy here, there's no honour in you killing yourself.
And it also will carry through for Black Panther, because you can tell he doesn't want to kill Claw, but he is tasked with doing that as king, and it's, when we join him, he's already kind of got this sort of level of humility and stuff, and it's just good stuff. So at the end of the movie, obviously, there are no Avengers, basically. Steve has left his shield behind, he goes into hiding with Bucky, he breaks all these captured heroes out of the raft, and he takes Bucky to Wakanda, where T'Challa promises to help cure Bucky once and for all of his brainwashing. And also, Rhodey is learning to walk again, thanks to some like advanced prosthetics that Tony has made him. And he's in rehab. And a FedEx driver turns up and delivers to Tony a phone and a letter from Cap, where, you know, Cap writes so beautifully, doesn't he? It's just a nice little closing point to their entire conflict and the point they're left at. And just the touch of, like, giving him the phone, where it's like, look, we're probably never going to be on an active team together, but if shit, like, really goes down, I can't not help, so phone me if you need to. And that's the end of your movie. And like the post credits scene is Peter in his room with a little spider signal type device from Tony. So some just tiny little miscellaneous bits here. Stan Lee is the FedEx driver, the second time he's playing a delivery driver in one of his cameos. I believe he was with UPS, maybe, I don't know, one of the others for like one of the Fantastic Fours. Jim Rash, as I said, is the MIT teacher. Joe Russo, one of the directors, was the murdered psychiatrist in the bathtub. You don't actually see him, just he's on the other side of a shower curtain. Anne Russo, the wife of Anthony Russo, is the voice of dead wife, and he just keeps listening to that voicemail. That is Anne Russo. Damien Poitier, who played Thanos in the first Avengers, is one of Crossbones' mercenaries, so nice little, you know, thanks sort of moment. Florence Kasumba is Ayo. She is one of the Dora Maje who is escorting T'Challa around. I really like the scene where she like steps up in Black Widow's face, and you're sort of like, at the time you're like, oh, that's cute, but now you've seen Black Panther, you're like, maybe this wouldn't be as clear-cut as you think. It's just fun, and I like that T'Challa's sort of amused by it as well. Carrie Condon is back as Friday. I do like the thing where he's like, have you done this? And she's like, what do I look like? And he's like, I don't know, I'm picturing a redhead. She is a redhead. It's also, and I can confirm, she is still Irish. So, I don't know. I guess when I watched them the first time, it didn't really bother me. But now I watched them again for this, I'm like, God, she's so Irish, isn't she?
Yeah, my girl Friday. Like, I don't know, I just associate that with Ireland, like, very much so.
Okay, yeah, well. The little moment towards the end where Bucky and Cap are entering the facility. Cap talks about a double date with Bucky, and that there was this woman called Dolores, or Dot, and I believe she matches a description for someone that Peggy fights in Agent Carter, who is like a Hydra experiment person, so it's probably the same person. I did the Blues Company thing, so yeah, that's all my miscellaneous stuff. So, do you have anything else you want to talk about before we get into those final segments?
This is a really good movie.
It is, isn't it? It's just great. The reason I would put it at potentially number one is that as someone who is religious to these films, like, I am there for every one of them, I care a lot, like, to see all of that investment paid back to me in what they do with it, with the drama, and to also have it take place in a film that is funny and dramatic and well acted and has loads of action and balances people well. And like, the thing I forgot to say that I think is the reason why the Russos are able to make all these characters work, and Joss struggled so much in the second one, is because by making it have a focus on this story of Cap, Bucky and Tony, by not pretending that everyone has to have the same level of importance as was attempted in both Avengers films, by letting Hawkeye just have a like 5-minute role, it's a far more effective role, and he is better served by just literally turning up and doing his couple of scenes than he is by them trying and failing to make him important. Everyone's role is clearly established, and like you said, like having Thanos be the focus of Infinity War will hopefully achieve a similar thing. But yeah, they showed a very effective way of juggling so many characters. Okay, so Villain Watch we kind of already did. Like, I wouldn't say it's a bad villain. It's just that the villain, it's so not the point of this film.
Yeah, I think it's the first time we've had, like, a properly secondary villain to, like, the actual plot. Like, Winter Soldier is probably the closest, again, to this. Is, like, neither of those movies had fights with a out-and-out villain at the very end. But I think this movie really nails, like, what they were trying to do with Pierce a little bit better. In yeah. that he has a personal stake with the Avengers rather than he is leader of an organization that is intrinsically linked to Nazis, which
yes,
one of them is more out and out villainous than the other. And I feel like this one, with its level, like, there are shades of grey to both sides and to this third side that's manipulating the two sides, which is appreciated in superhero movies. Like, you have Batman is the closest to coming to, like, shades of grey, where vigilantism is a bad thing, but you're fighting against incarnate evil with Joker and stuff like that. And so there's things in there that they're grappling with, ideas and morality and stuff like that. Whereas this is the first Marvel movie that doesn't have, these are the good guys, these are the bad guys, the good guys will win at the end. Whereas this one kind of, like, comes away going, like, I don't know who won this.
It's nuanced. It's not clear-cut. Zemo won. Like, he destroyed the Avengers. There is no Avengers team at the end of this. That is an irreparable damage to that relationship between Cap and Tony. So, you know, as I said, while he's not a big flashy villain, I don't think he's a weakness to this film in any way. Because he's not, like, a big booming villain. He is, as you said, a secondary villain.
He's probably the best villain we've had since Loki. Which, I mean, at this point is 4 years later. We finally get someone who is, I mean, and obviously, like, you feel stronger about Ultron than I do, but I do feel that Zemo fits into this movie more seamlessly than Ultron did, where Ultron is bigger than some of the events in Age of Ultron. And so it's good that, like, we're getting back into more character-focused stuff. And it's a trend of, like, there are a lot of villains in Phase 3 who I think function a lot better than those they did in Phase 2.
Yeah. Okay, so the third act doesn't need a lot of talking, but it's absolutely tremendous. Some of the most emotional stuff that's ever been pulled off in a superhero movie, delivering that great fight scene between two iconic characters, something that Batman vs. Superman could not match a month earlier, where they had two more iconic characters, and yet they couldn't get there.
It's weird. Avengers has that victory lap of Act 3, which is just sustained fun, and basically Joss Whedon getting to run around and go, like, look, we did it, and it pays off wonderfully. Whereas in this movie,
it does that in the middle.
It does that in the middle, and then they come back and go, like, right, now we're doing all the character stuff. And this is the best. I think Avengers in my heart will always be my favorite Act 3, but, like, this is the best. This is the one that completely fucking nails every single emotional character beat, and it's just astounding that, like, they give you that, like, height of adrenaline at the end of Act 2, and then they come back for this, and they're just like, right, now we're ready to make you have feelings, and you're just like, oh, God. Like, because it gets dark, like, the movie, the change in lighting and tone, it just shifts into this, like, once Rhodey gets hit, the movie changes.
Yeah, to go from that big outdoor scene with everyone running around to, even when Tony's visiting them in prison, stormy seas, it's almost nighttime, if not actually nighttime, and then just to have this all take place in this dank Siberian facility, it all just fits so well. So the one I think we're going to struggle with here, also maybe not, outstanding performances. So we have one spare from Age of Ultron, so we can conceivably give nods to two people from this. Now, most of these characters have already appeared, and for me, the hard thing is, because, like, we can just say something like, oh yeah, Tom Holland, but I think it's pretty clear he's going to outdo himself in Homecoming, so it almost seems like a waste of time. But for me, the thing that's difficult is Robert Downey Jr. giving a better performance here than in Iron Man? I think Chris Evans might be easier to say one way or the other, and that would replace his Winter Soldier one. I would probably say yes to Chris Evans.
I think Chris Evans gets more of the focus in Winter Soldier, but, like, I'm quibbling, like, it's a 1A, 1B. Okay. Like, this is, like, those two movies are the best that Chris Evans has been.
Yeah.
Whereas,
The difficult one is Robert Downey Jr., because I would say that this is better emotional, dramatic acting, but Iron Man 1 is a 90-minute exercise of, hey, look at me, look how much I can lead a film. It's just going to fall down to which we would rather reward, because those are two completely different things, and I think there's no doubt whatsoever that there's more acting happening here, but just that lead role it's not a star-making performance because he was already a known entity, but like a catapulting him into a new level with Iron Man 1. And like, he launched the MCU on the back of that performance in many ways. So I don't know if I'd feel good about either option in some ways, because something's going to lose out.
I have to give it to Downey for this movie.
Yeah, I'm willing to go with you. It's just I don't want to completely toss out how important his performance is in Iron Man 1. But for me, it's more about acting than it is about importance in all of this stuff, which is why I try and rally for someone like Ultron, where like I think the acting performance is so good. And I think, again, here, it's like, you know, the stuff they're pulling off with him, where he's running the full spectrum. He's being quippy, he's being sad, he's being difficult, he's doing action, and then that huge dramatic bit at the end, it's all just insane. Like, worth every penny of his contract, I think.
Yeah, I don't think we throw away anything by saying this is the best one, because I think this is, as I've said before, like, this is a movie that builds on the entire MCU. This is not a movie which you go into watching the two Captain America movies. Like, to get the most out of this movie, you need to see the two Captain America movies, the three Iron Man movies, and the two Avengers movies. And I think it's a conclusion to the progression of the character. Because I don't think we're not going to get the level of like emotionality out of Downey Jr. in Infinity War just based on what that movie's going to be. It's not going to have time for stuff like this.
Yeah.
But like, this is, we get little bits of the quippy Robert Downey Jr., Tony Stark in this film. It's not as much, and it's not obviously as based around ad-lib as the first Iron Man movie is.
Well, he's grown up, Ben. He's growing as a human at age 48 or whatever.
But yes. But like, it still feels like that character. And I just...
It's a three-dimensional person. It all builds on everything, and it's all logical, and it's all been a journey, and it's all come to this point, and it's still got room to keep going. And I'm really glad he took his shot, like, as a real person, and said, no, let's beef my role up, let's have this be a full-on argument of hearts and minds between Tony Stark and Steve Rogers, and it all just paid off. So yeah, I'd be fully willing to say that this replaces the Iron Man 1. I'd be happy to leave Chris Evans with his Winter Soldier 1. I think he's always been really difficult to pin down, because he's not doing that sort of crowd-pleasing acting. He's just being really solid.
I think I actually quite like the idea of giving it to both of them for this movie.
Yeah,
I actually like the symmetry of that, which is like we are pitting the two of them up against in their strongest movie, because it is an ideological debate. And I think, like, when I think of this movie, I think of there are more little character beats in this one that I prefer to Winter Soldier. When I think of Winter Soldier, I come down to interactions with people and Samuel L. Jackson in that car chase and stuff like that. Whereas here, I'm just like, oh, it's Cap talking to Spider-Man about being from Brooklyn.
Well, that's the thing. That's why I think I'm slightly more down on Winter Soldier than other people, because to me, it's like a tremendous proof of concept that you can do a more thriller-based, political-based, mentally-based superhero movie. And then they marry that with the big pompous grand stuff and all of that, and you get something like this. So yeah, for sure, I think I would rather give it to the two of them. And as I said, if we want, we can give a pick to Tom Holland, but just unless you've got controversial views about Spider-Man Homecoming, I think we're gonna say he's gonna beat himself in Homecoming. So
yeah, but like, and it's what, like, we're at the point now where, like, if we give it to Downey and we give it to Chris Evans, they just replace their previous one, so we would have two spare. So we still have two spare from this one. So
well, I think we're gonna need some for upcoming episodes, so I'm happy with that.
We are both of very similar opinion. Like, this is in my top three MCU films.
Yeah,
this is like potentially your favorite.
For me, it depends what day you ask, but it's gonna be this, it's gonna be Ragnarok, it's maybe going to be Avengers 1.
Yeah, this is the one where I think of it is in terms of the exact opposite of Black Panther, in that I think Black Panther is a fantastic standalone movie that doesn't require knowledge of anything else and is better than the other superhero origin movies, whereas this one I think is proof of concept that a shared universe movie series can work, and you can convince an audience to go see all of these films and have it not be confusing. There is still standalone stuff in this movie, but so much of the emotional payoff to this film is working off the fact that, like, you have 12 movies preceding this to pay off. And yeah, like, this is, it's astounding that this worked. Like, it's astounding that Avengers worked based off the back of 5 movies. It's even more astounding that this movie works off the back of 12.
Yes.
And we're coming into now, we're moving into 18 movies for Infinity War, and we'll see whether or not that can top this.
Well, yes, this is the first movie in Phase 3. Phase 3 has been pretty fucking good so far. So, yeah, it's appropriate.
Like, apart from this movie, I think Phase 3 gets continually better with each progressive movie. Like, I think we dip down with Doctor Strange after this, but only to a level of, like, it's an origin movie that's about as good as the other origin movies. And yes, then every single step after that is better and better and better and better. And Phase 3 is so good.
It is. This has been another long one, as could be expected with everything that goes on. As Ben said, Doctor Strange will be our next stop. I challenge us to make that not long, because I don't know how we even could. That will be next time. In the meantime, go to entertherealworld.com, reelworld.com. Check out all the stuff there. Listen to From Broadcast Depth, which is our Lost podcast hosted by Kevin Ford and Ben Lundy. And just generally, just help us out. Support, comment, subscribe, like, all that shit. Dude, live your life. And this has been our Civil War. I spent this whole episode wearing an Iron Man t-shirt, and, like, I feel bad because no one's Team Iron Man in this.
I have a Captain America cushion on my lap.
Was that to just control the raging erection you got when you rewatched him bicep curling a helicopter?
No, my lap was just cold.
No, okay.